This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil, now streaming, only on Hulu.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the New Book Podcast. I'm Deidre Tyler, host. Today, we'll be talking with Dr. Sade M. Davis, author and editor of Being Black in the Ivory Tower, Truth-Telling About Racism in Higher Education. How are you doing today?
I'm doing well, thank you. It's Happy Friday.
Yes. You know, I was wondering if you could start by saying a few words about yourself and how you got started on this project.
So I am an associate professor. Really, just that first line is exciting because I'm a Black woman who earned tenure. So that alone is certainly something to celebrate and to get excited about. But associate professor in communication at the University of Connecticut. And an enthusiast of all things Black women. That's my wheelhouse. My line of research examines Black womanhood and Black women's sisterhood. But how I got involved with, how Black in the Ivory came to be is through a hashtag that went viral in June of 2020. And it's wild because as a scholar, a lot of people assume that I study media, right? That I study social media specifically, and maybe the virality of messages and things in that realm. And I'm like, yeah, no. Or maybe education, higher education. I'm like, no. This all came about because of a viral hashtag.
So you can tell us more about June 6, 2020, when things were going on in the news and it created a lot of mental and emotional frustration.
It did. And we all have collective trauma, right? Regarding that time. And some can recall it like it was yesterday, and some probably have suppressed the memory. For me, I can still recall it vividly. I was in San Diego, which is also home, where I'm born and raised. That's what I mean when I say home. And I happened to be in San Diego and had to get an Airbnb because I was like, I'm not going back to Connecticut. I don't know what the heck is going on. And so I was there from March on. May was obviously there was just a string of events, right? We had Ahmaud Arbery, we had Breonna Taylor, obviously, George Floyd, and there was civil unrest all over the world. And I was reeling. And I was exasperated. I didn't know what to do. I was just so disheartened and demoralized. And I was going to protests, even though we were still in lockdown. But it just wasn't, it's like my soul was uneasy, right? And there was something I was feeling at the depths, right? The depths of my soul that was like a few marches or maybe like a therapy session just wasn't going to remedy. And I was thinking about, what was transpiring with the police. And I'm thankful that I don't have a personal story regarding, you know, encounters with the police and police brutality, either with myself or with like close loved ones. I don't. I'm very thankful to be able to say that as a Black woman in America. But I still felt so strongly connected to what was happening. And so I had a lot of time on my hands as I'm, you know, in a Airbnb in San Diego by myself for months on end. And so I was thinking about, why do I feel like, you know, I can't personally connect to this, but I feel like I can. And why is that? And I was thinking, and I was like, because I have encountered another, like the root of what's happening is anti-Black racism. Police brutality is one sprout, right? It's one, you know, branch from that seed. But there are many others. And I was thinking about, I know quite intimately what it's like to experience anti-Black racism in another branch. And that was higher education. That was academia. And so once that came bubbled up to my consciousness, I was like, oh my gosh, yeah. That's what it is. And I was on Twitter. I had left Twitter for a while during, I just left Twitter. And so, but during that time, I was utilizing Twitter a lot more. Honestly, for the protests and for news, it was a better source of news than CNN and MSNBC any day. And so I was, you know, really turning to social media just to connect with other people. Again, I was alone in lockdown. And so I found social media to kind of be like this old friend I could turn to. And so in that Saturday night, June 6th, 2020, I was thinking about my own experiences with anti-Black racism in academia. And I was like, well, I think I'm going to share some stories. And I'm good for like a little pithy phrase or like a little, you know, I'm good for coming up with things like that. And so I was like, you know, I'm going to like create a hashtag, but it was really just for me to use, you know what I mean? Like thinking about like, what's a way to tie everything together, like if I want to share multiple stories, I want people to know like what this is about. And I was like, oh, okay. Maybe like Black in the Ivory. And I was like, yeah, that's it. It's Black in the Ivory. That's exactly what it is. And man, wow. Just that resonated with people who like, I had no idea that other people, not that they weren't experiencing it, but that in that moment, in that time, right. Thinking about the right place, the right space, the right time, the right moment. So many other people, I think, needed to not necessarily vent, but to share, right? And in the same way I did, and they did share. A lot of them shared.
Wow. So social media, I mean, how did this tag reach so many people so quickly? Tell us about that.
I mean, I think a lot of it is, I wrote in the preface of the book that it really was like, I think a platform, a right space, a right time, a right moment. Because, you know, now, you know, everybody's here, there, and everywhere, right? We've got jobs and kids and our own lives. But that was a moment where we were all hunkered down, right? And our eyes were affixed to media. We're affixed to our TVs, right? Maybe to get news and things like that. We're affixed to movies, you know, Netflix to pass the time. And we're affixed to social media, again, to find community and again, to exchange resources. So I think that was such a unique moment where there were so many people who were active and engaged at one, you know, point in time. And I think also, because it may not necessarily have been about police brutality, which was certainly part of the capital C conversation at that moment. But obviously, you know, anti-Black racism largely was a huge issue. So thinking about just the topic as well. And then lastly, you know, academics, a lot of us, you know, live in isolation. Like we're like the only one, you know what I mean? Might be the only Black person in our department or in our college or person of color, you know, you're maybe only one of a few people of color in your college. And so I think it also provided some connective tissue for Black academics, as I call them, to be able to say like, oh my gosh, like, you mean I'm not the only one who's been going through this? I've been living in the margins for so many years, and I've been gaslit or race-lit, as there are two scholars who came with this concept of race lighting. But, you know, I've been gaslit for so many years, think it's me. People made it seem like it was me. It was my fault, right? Like I was culpable for these racist acts that they were, you know, painting as something else. But really, it was racist, right? And so it was just this perfect storm. I think it was a perfect storm, and it did it grow like wildfire, literally overnight. That was Saturday, June 6th, 2020, that night. And the next day on Sunday, and then on Sunday it was in the top 10 or top 20 hashtags on Twitter. It went overseas, like it was crazy.
Well, tell us about some of the stories about racism in academic environments that you found.
So what's really interesting and always, gives me pause, and I think gives other people pause too, is, you know, Black in the Ivory really sits, some could say, like in contrast to what we saw with the police brutality, right? Because we know that racism takes many forms, but we could dichotomize it to think about it as overt and covert, right? The overt is the, you know, the in your face. It is very, demonstrative. It's more easily identifiable. But then you also have the covert. Some people might, racial microaggressions, for example, is a part of our kind of lexicon in the past few years. But that covert racism is a little bit harder to detect, right? It's a little more implicit, right? As opposed to the overt racist acts that are very like explicit. And so with Black in the Ivory, there were a lot more of the covert, there was a lot more stories of covert racism, which is really interesting because I think people at that time were looking for just these very like, you know, just to be aghast and to be, you know, hearing these stories about, you know, Black folks being hosed down, you know what I mean? And had dogs put on them, thinking about like the 50s and the 60s peak protests. And then again, thinking about like racism again in that very big, large, explicit way. But no, not at all. There were stories of, you know, people in the classroom, if you're, you know, a Black graduate student and you have someone coming up to you and asking, you know, or actually, no, this is another common one. You have Black faculty where they're on campus and people are assuming like they're a staff person. And then they might correct them and say, nope, I'm faculty. You know, I'm Dr. So-and-so. And then the person insists on referring to them by their first name, right? As a way of perhaps putting them in their place and not recognizing, you know, their place, their rank and, you know, high place of power within the university. There were Black folks who were trying to get into a university building and were stopped by security and then had police called on them because they were accused of trespassing, right? As though they did not belong, even after showing their identification, their university identification. Still had police and there was being interrogated again because it how dare a Black person think that they have a right to access the building that they work in, you know? I even think of my own where in my dissertation defense it was very uncomfortable. Like I weeped, I cried and cried and cried and not tears of joy. And it was a room full of white people and they had accused me of being defensive and argumentative during my dissertation defense. And so they were, you know, they were definitely, you know, giving me a heavy hand in terms of their line of questioning, but I knew my stuff. And so I retorted back, but because it came out of a Black woman's body, it was read a particular way. Right. And so what happens is they didn't like that I retorted. So then they, you know, they increased it a bit more, right? They then got a little bit more, I guess you said like they turned up the heat, right? As a way of trying to put me in my place. And so, you know, it's these stories. It's these stories. And research shows, I'll say this, research shows on racial microaggressions that it has a comparable impact on our mental health than overt racist acts. So even though they may be implicit, even though they might be covert, even though they may be quote unquote seemingly small, they have just as much of an impact as if someone referred to you as a racial epithet. Right. Or the police did a stop and frisk on you in your car simply because maybe you're driving a luxury car. This comparable impact. So racism, regardless of its face, still affects people very similarly. And I think that for me is very eye opening and astounding.
Now, in your book, you talk about the term anti-Black racism. Can you tell the audience more about that?
Yeah. So we have race as a social construct that was totally arbitrary. And then race became a system. So you've heard of like systemic racism, which means that it goes beyond people, right? You can have really kind people in the world and racism can still exist. You can have, let's say, white people who are great accomplices in this work and great allies in this work, and racism can still exist because it's bubbled up into a system. Racism affects everyone who is not white in the United States, like Latinx people, Black people, Native Indigenous people, Asian people, right? We all are our targets and are negatively affected by racism, which is racism or systemic racism is the arbitrary and disparate treatment of people of color, of people who are not white. Right. And racism can take, again, different forms in terms of prejudice, in terms of discrimination. And so when thinking about racism and how it affects so many communities of color, there's some nuance, right? There's some nuance there and some complexity. And there's an opportunity for us to say, yeah, me as a Black person, I am negatively affected or I experience negative treatment just because of the color of my skin in the same way a Latino person does. But also, if we want to dig a little deeper, there's some nuance there because how I'm treated as a Black person, as a descendant of an enslaved African, is qualitatively different. Let's say then someone who is Asian, maybe Korean, maybe their first generation, their parents immigrated here from Korea, right? So the ways in which racism shows up for, let's say, a Korean person is going to be different, very different than someone who is Black. And again, a descendant of an enslaved African. And also as Black people, we are, at least in the, this generation of Black people in this contemporary era, we are Americans, right? And so there's something qualitatively different there. And so we have a unique, there's a unique type of way in which racism affects us. And so that is how the term anti-Black racism came to be.
Now, you also talk about these two terms, critical race theory and Black critical theory. What's the difference?
Excuse me. critical race theory gets a lot of heat. I don't know why in recent years. I think it's just it's just conjured up, right? Just for political purposes. But critical race theory, honestly and truthfully, it is simply a theoretical framework that was advanced to be able to articulate more succinctly and easily that racism exists in the United States, that it is historicized, which means racism didn't just come about, you know, in the past 20 years. There's a history of it. It's rooted in our history, certainly dating all the way back to colonization of the Americas. Some could even date it back before then, but at least here in the United States. Colonization and the genocide and ethnocide of Native Indigenous people, of course, chattel slavery of Africans who were captured from the continent. And so it is a number of tenets, maybe about four or five tenets, I believe, I could be wrong, but of a theory that literally just says, we acknowledge that racism exists in the United States, And that because racism exists, there is a power differential between white people and people of color, right? And that people of color, then when we share our stories, when we talk about racism, society as a whole, at least here in the United States, for example, is going to find ways to silence those voices, silence those truths, right? Silence those experiences, because there is a particular dominant narrative that society, America, wants to perpetuate. And that dominant narrative is that whether it's direct or indirect, white people are the norm. Whiteness is the norm. Anything associated with European, white, American life, culture, race is the norm, is ideal, and is good. And so it's a theory that just articulates that. But for some reason, that makes people uncomfortable. I guess, you know, we're in the era of reinventing truth, coming up with your own truth and reinventing history, alternative facts, right? With Black Crit, it takes critical race theory a step further and again is offering some specificity. So in the way that I talked about that shift from racism to anti-Black racism, Black Crit was advanced to say, yes, we totally understand this about racism and how racism was erected, but we need to have a specific theory about Black people in particular. Right? And thinking critically about the treatment of Black people in the United States, right? And I talked about anti-Black racism, but also the anti-Blackness that is erected here in the United States, which is just simply to say anything that is associated with Black people, Black culture in the United States is deemed inferior, is deemed worthy of being marginalized, is deemed lacking value. And so Black Crit is just a way of offering some specificity to that.
Now, you use the term counter narratives. Mm-hmm. Tell the audience about this.
So I was talking about critical race theory. And I said, you know, one of the tenets of critical race theory is our stories or these narratives, right, that get erected in the United States. And so we have dominant narratives, right? Again, you can even think about this very simply in terms of, let's say, history. There was, for anyone who might be a millennial, a Gen Xer, a baby boomer right now, you probably can recall being in elementary school and learning a particular American history, right? And so in those textbooks, they were perpetuating a dominant narrative, right? You learned about Christopher Columbus in a very particular way, that he discovered, quote unquote, discovered America, right? You learned about these presidents, maybe Abraham Lincoln, and how he had a heart for the slaves and he wanted to end racism, you know, because he saw that it was a morally corrupt system. And now we learned that that's not true. So there are these dominant narratives that are pervasive in the United States. And again, it is to maintain these systems, right? This system of race, right? Racism. It is to maintain white power and white privilege, right? It is to maintain white normativity and whiteness as the standard. And so for people of color, we have a very different perspective, right? Understandably so, about the United States. We have a different standpoint and viewpoint about what's happened in our own, narrative. But the reason why it's counter is because it is counter or it is different from that dominant narrative. And as I was saying before, how one of the tenets of critical race theory is that often people who share counter narratives are often silenced, right? And they are deemed to be, you know, lacking credibility, right? And so we shouldn't listen to them. They are maybe deemed to be unintelligent, right? So that they don't, to then perpetuate or purport that they don't have the you know, aptitude or the capability of being able to even construct a story, right? You know, they try to find ways to invalidate our counter stories, but it's only because our counter stories subvert or go against the dominant story. And they want to maintain the dominant story in order to maintain power.
Black academic storytelling. What can we learn from that?
We are in a, you know, Black academics, as I refer to them, we're such a unique, you know, class of people, because many of us are, you know, educated, college educated, and then thinking about faculty, you know, you've got a bachelor's, a master's, and a PhD, right? You've gone through the tenure and promotion process. So you've got people who, you know, relative to the masses in society, have an incredible, scholarly aptitude and intelligence. And so it's really interesting to think about our way of storytelling and the stories that we have to tell, because, you know, I can safely say that many of us have sat with these stories, right? And have maybe shared them within the confines of our, like, closed spaces, maybe with like another Black colleague, or maybe with a partner, romantic partner, right? Maybe with some girlfriends, but rarely have we ever had the opportunity to like share it with others. So it's interesting how we, I think we have the capacity to be able to name and understand what's happening. And I hold that as truth, right? Again, just because of like the amount of education, right? We've gotten in scholarly, you know, experience we have in the university. So we hold that as truth, but that's also coupled with the fact that we're still Black, right? And we are still confronting racism day in and day out. And it's one thing to experience racism with a whole bunch of other Black people. It's another thing. It's a very different experience to experience racism day in and day out when you are the only Black person in your space. So you don't have anyone to do that sanity check with, to be like, am I crazy? Or did this person just do that because I'm Black? Right. And so when it comes to Black academic storytelling, I find it to just be so fascinating and interesting and unique. Because we are still Black and we still struggle and have struggled to make sense of what's happening, even though many of us are more than capable of studying it. I study race and racism and sexism. I study Black women, right? And as an academic, I was struggling with the racist acts that I experienced and the racist experiences that I've had in the past, right? So it's such an interesting place to be. And I think it just goes to show, again, the strength and power of systemic racism in the U.S. And I think it is the might, right? The might of systemic racism in the U.S. that even people who study it for a living sometimes struggle to even make sense of it in their own life.
Now, you had an open call for people to share. Tell us about how that was set up.
I did. Once the book contract was in place and I really wanted the book to, I was talking with the editor and I said, you know, I really want this book to reflect what the hashtag is. And the hashtag was a collection of, I mean, tweets, right? I mean, the hashtag is people tweeting, which is like 140 characters, right? So people are sharing these small, bite-sized yet powerful stories. So I wanted the book to reflect that. Typically in academia, when there's an edited book, right, you have an editor and then they solicit different contributions from scholars in a field or an area. Typically they're like book chapters, right? And they're very scholarly and typically a little bit long. They might, you know, present some data, or it might be an essay. But I rarely see, you know, short, brief stories. And so for me, it was really important to have that. And so also typically in edited books, the editor would go and invite everyone who they wanted to be in the book. And so it's an invitation only contribution. But for this, the hashtag saw no, you know, it didn't discriminate. Anyone could in June, you know, of 2020, anyone could share their story with the hashtag. And so I wanted the book to reflect that, even down to the process. And I said, I want this to be open. And if somebody wants to share, I want them to receive the invitation to do so. And if they choose to accept, awesome. And if they don't, that's okay too. And so I did an open call on Twitter and, you know, emails and to spread the word. And there are a number of people who submitted to be a part of the book. And I'm so thankful for that.
Now, the first part of the book, you have the experiences of the undergraduate life. Share some parts of that.
Mm-hmm. So with the book, absolutely, there are the four sections. And I really wanted to call in the fact that there are a lot of undergraduate experiences. Once you get into the throes of academia, you oftentimes really just hear about like grad students and faculty. And that is kind of the lion's share of the stories. But I definitely wanted to make space for the undergrads, especially because, you know, we're talking about student loans and, you know what I mean, high cost of education. And so, you know, thinking about those four or so or more years in a young adult's life, and especially those who are on predominantly, you know, white campuses, where they might be like one of a few hundred in like a school of 30,000, right? I wanted the world to be able to read what it might be like from that perspective. And I'm thankful it opened with, there were some people who I did invite. There was an open call. So I did use a both and approach. I didn't open call, but there were some people I did invite to be a part of the book because there were certain stories I knew I really wanted told. I wanted to make sure we're a part of the collection, and I wasn't sure if it was going to come through, in the kind of inductive way, right? Naturally on its own. And so there are some voices I really wanted to be a part of it. And so JL Karandi, excuse me, she opens, she's the lead narrative for that section. And for those who don't know her, or maybe the name sounds familiar, JL was the first Black woman student body president at the University of Minnesota in Minneapolis. And you might recall her because after George Floyd's murder by the police, JL, when she was a student body president, got the university to sever ties with the police in 24 hours, which is huge, huge for an entire university within 24 hours to agree to sever ties with the Minneapolis Police Department. And I was so inspired by this young lady at that time. This was in, I believe May, end of May 2020, or maybe beginning of June of 2020. She inspired me so much. I knew that, you know, later on when doing the book, that I really would love to have her voice in there, to be able to share that story, because I honestly, her story, what she did with the Minneapolis, that affected me in when it happened, when I was in lockdown and I was reeling and I was exasperated and I was trying to figure out how to channel this energy and what I could do, right? How can I help? I actually was so inspired by JL that I worked with, and I wrote right about this in the preface, I worked with a graduate student to see if I could be able to do this at my university in Connecticut. And so that's how much she inspired me. You know, it was just very apropos for her to be a part of this book and to open up, to start out that section.
Now, part two deals with the survival of graduate school. What's the overall message from that section?
Graduate school is tough. If anyone has ever been enrolled in graduate school of any kind, any graduate program. And it's certainly, there are a number of students in there who are PhD students, which is a very particular kind of a graduate program. I think one of the biggest themes, I think there are actually a number of themes, but I think something that a lot of the graduate students experienced, if I take a step back from the stories in that section, is like being patronized, right? It's interesting, you have grown adults who, you know, are in their late 20s, 30s, sometimes 40s, could be even older, but who get treated like children and again, silenced and not believed, ignored, their needs ignored, their requests ignored, as an adult might do a child. And so that's one of the themes that sticks out to me and actually also resonates with just my own personal experience as well, is that even as a grown adult, I felt as though in graduate school, there was this very weird parent-child-like relationship between myself and my advisor and just myself and faculty. Right. Rather than us all being adults and me trying to further my career. And I think that's true just in some, you know, grad programs in general, but I think especially as a Black person. Right. Again, thinking about how racism takes shape.
Part three, moving up the academic ranks.
Mm-hmm. In this section, you have faculty and some administrators, but across different, you know, levels, those who just entered into maybe a tenure track assistant professor role to those who have, you know, write about being in academia for many years. And I think the stories from my perspective in this section get a little bit more intense. You know, I think about one contributor who writes about like a pending, you know, like lawsuit, like legal case between her and the university because of disparate or discrimination that she experienced. You know, I think about, you know, Dr. Donald Collins, if I'm not mistaken, or maybe it was Dr. Paul Harris, who was denied tenure. And it was in the news, right? It was in the news, but it was denied tenure and tried to fight it. And, you know, the exhaustion of doing so, you know, I think about, you know, Dr., I believe, Michael Arrington, who writes about the effects of what he was experiencing as faculty on his health. He said, you know, in terms of his weight, right? And in terms of his psychological health and in terms of his stress levels, and I think his hair, he said, was falling out. And so, you know, yeah, it gets a little bit more intense in that section, and it gets a little bit more raw in that section across the stories.
And part four, you talk about seeking alternatives to the academic area.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I write in the introduction how there's certainly kind of like an arc within across the sections. And it really, you know, peaks once you read some of the faculty stories. And then you come, there's kind of a decrescendo down to this section. There are significantly less stories in this section than the other ones. And at first, you know, I thought about, and I write about this in the book, I thought about, you know, should I try to backfill? Should I try to extend another call just for this section? But I really wanted to stick to the open and inductive nature of doing this book. And whatever came, you know, from that open call is what came. And perhaps it's just what's reflective of a certain phenomena that is worthy of discussion, right? Could it be that there aren't a lot of academics who are seeking alternatives or who have sought alternatives? Or could it be that perhaps those who have sought alternatives were not I weren't reached with my open call, right? My emails and my tweets just weren't getting to them, perhaps because they're not connected to the academic community anymore. So maybe it was a recruitment. It was a methodological, I don't want to say error, but it's due to the methods, right? I don't know. I don't know. But I like that it actually ends that way. Across the four sections, because I think it extends a really great opportunity for people to think, I think for conversation among maybe a group of folks who are reading the book, and for folks to maybe speculate. It's like a cliffhanger. It's like, okay, well, maybe you can think about it some more. Maybe there'll be a part two, right? And the next book can pick up where this one left off. But it was important for me to include this because the arc of this book is really about, you know, Black academics us having choices. And I really wanted to emphasize that in this last section to say, hey, there are people who have thought about, you know, leaving, or who have thought about a different way of doing academia. And that was important for me, for any reader who may have lost sight of that, who may have forgotten that about their agency.
Now, what is the overall message you want to leave the reader with once they finish your book?
Honestly, it is that. It is, you know, I write that the book is written for and by, it's written by Black academics and it's written for Black academics. Everyone, whether you're in academia, whether you're Black, or whether you're not in academia and you're not Black, you can get something from this. I think it absolutely can very much apply to your own life, your own work life, or maybe just other facets of society that you're in. There's definitely something you can glean from it. I also think that anyone who wants to be an accomplice in this work on anti-Black racism, that it's important for continued education. And so this book is another great resource to add to one's arsenal for that continued education. Because we had a lot of people who said, I'm listening, you know, I'm listening, I'm on the front lines, I champion this work, I'm a social justice warrior, who were saying that in 2020, and it's been 4 years. Been 4 years. So what have they done? Are they still listening? And are they still a social justice warrior, right? So I think this book can also serve as a way to ring the alarm and say, you know, hey, were you taking a nap? Wake up. What have you done, right? Like, test is, you know, you had 4 years turning your answers. Let's evaluate. Let's evaluate what you've done with your time, right, after making such a loud commitment. So, I think it's, you know, there are multiple goals with this book, but the primary one is for the Black academics to whom this book is dedicated to and written to. And it's to say, again, you have choices. If academia is, even if you have a PhD or if you have a master's and you are believing you have to stay within this institution, I'm here to tell you, to decree today, you do not. If it is not serving you, don't stay, right? If your health has been compromised, right, beyond repair, you don't have to stay. You absolutely have the agency and the know-how and the creativity. I mean, our people are so ingenious. So we have all the tools to be able to pivot and to shift into another field or entrepreneurship, whatever it may be. But we are not beholden, even if you've got a PhD, to stay within academia. That skill set, your skill sets and your talents can be parlayed into some other profession. And so I really want to, in just a provide like that loving reminder to Black academics to always remember that, and to always remember our agency and our autonomy and ability to make choices. Society has a funny way, again, racism rearing its ugly head, you know, a funny way of telling us we don't have choices, right? That we have to accept what's given to us. So this is just one, you know, me doing my due diligence to remind my people, no, baby, don't believe they hype. We absolutely have choices. And I want to encourage people to take the time to reflect on their own experiences of anti-Black racism, and to acknowledge, to get some validation that, yes, that was racist, right? To sit with that and then to go on a journey of healing and to try to get a little bit more sober-minded, clear-minded, so that as they are thinking about their next steps, right, they can do so not from a place of trauma and from a place of scarcity and from a place of anger or perhaps I don't want them to make the decision from that place. I want my people to make a decision from a very clear-minded, peaceful place. And so, but that comes a little bit later in the journey after doing some of the inner work. So I hope this book will help people along their journey, or maybe encourage people to start that journey.
Well, I've taken up enough of your time. Can you tell us the next project you'll be working on?
So right now, I just wrapped up Bless a Black Graduate Student, Cycle 3. So I look forward to announcing the four winners of that. Bless a Black Graduate Student is a initiative that's been going on since June of 2020 with Black in the Ivory. It's just a way to recognize that our Black graduate students could probably use a little extra blessing during that time, during that season of their life, and a monetary blessing. And Bless a Black Graduate Student is an initiative, is a program to do that and to provide just a very easy, uncomplicated way of getting money into Black graduate students' pockets. And so we just wrapped up Cycle 3. Those winners will be announced. Each one will receive $500 cash. So I'm really excited to continue that and just to continue to be a blessing to our students. And we'll continue on. The book just came out at the end of February. We're taking a recess for summer. Everyone, you know, I think needs a break right now. And then in fall, we'll gear up for some more book events and talks. And finally, encourage everyone to just continue to follow what's happening with Black in the Ivory. I'm doing some work with actually some of the contributors who are in the healing and therapy space to possibly create some national affinity groups for Black academics across the U.S. So we're in talks. We're in talks about that, and working to see if we can take this idea from an idea to fruition. So there is a group of them who's doing some amazing, amazing work, and I'm just there as a support system and to help again to bring that into fruition if we can.
Sounds like great projects. And thank you again for being on the podcast.
Thank you so much. And if I can say, everyone can follow me on Twitter or X. My personal Twitter is @ Dr. Shardae Davis, SHARDEDAV as in Victor, IS. And I also hope that you'll follow Black in the Ivory also on Twitter, which is @ Black in the Ivory. I'm also on Instagram, same handle, @ Dr. Shardae Davis. And you can also look up all this information and even buy the book. You can go to www.blackintheivory.net, and all the purchase links are there.
Thank you.
Thank you.